From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later on, psychic powers and mentalism with Clint Marsh. Get ready for that. Here's what's happening. Well, these are threats. They came in the mail, and to date, there have now been 25 letters that are warning of nuclear bombs destroying America. People who got them called the FBI. They were scared. The Bureau Chicago office is leading the investigation. An FBI agent says, yep, people were alarmed, many of them. The letter inside said that the Al-Qaeda organization has planted 160 nuclear bombs throughout the United States in schools, stadiums, churches, stores, financial institutions, and government buildings. This is a suicide mission for us, it went on to say. The writer, who claims to be Osama bin Laden, tells the reader the nukes are remotely controlled. Not to worry. However, agencies in Oregon, California, Texas, and Florida also got the letter with the Chicago postmark. Paul Williams, Ph.D., has served as a consultant for the FBI, editor and publisher of The Metro in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and an adjunct professor of humanities at the University of Scranton. He has authored more than 20 books, his latest being The Day of Islam. And Paul, I want to get your take on this story. As bizarre as it sounds, you did sound the alarm many years ago about the possibility of 6 nukes being planted in U.S. cities. What's your take on this one?
It's going to happen, George. It's only a matter of time. I mean, anyone that looked into it, I mean, really looked into the possibility of Al-Qaeda having nukes and a nuclear attack on American soil, has agreed that it's only a matter of time. I'm talking about people like Graham Allison from Harvard's Belfer Center. I'm talking Bill Keller from the New York Times. Everyone that looked seriously into this matter has come to one conclusion, that it will happen. Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, has been in search of nuclear materials since 1993, when he was in the Sudan. And according to all reports, he has acquired a considerable supply of highly enriched uranium and even plutonium.
But 160 cities? What do you think?
I think it's very possible, especially if he's talking about dirty nuclear attacks, irradiated waste. I mean, you can obtain from any food processing plant. Some of it you can obtain from hospitals. And all you need to do with the radiated material is wrap it around a firecracker, for heaven's sake, and set it off in Las Vegas. And man, guess what? You have you have an incident that's going to kill many, many thousands of people, and it's going to make an area uninhabitable for a considerable amount of time.
Now, these particular letters, Paul, though, that went on all over the place. I mean, do you think it's a hoax at this particular time? What do you think they are?
I think it might have been it's either one or two things, of course, George, as you know. One, it could be a hoax, but secondly, it could be a reaction to our new invasion of yet another Islamic country, which I don't think the Muslim world is viewing too favorably. And I think in response to that, I think that it's very possible that we could be. We could undergo a massive nuclear attack from Al-Qaeda within the next few months.
All right. This is a major story. It's a very bizarre story. Paul Williams, thank you. Paul's website will be on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. I'm going to take the posture that this is a hoax, that it was just merely one of those things to scare people. But it is a major story, and you'll probably hear more about it in the days to come. The International Atomic Energy Agency has told Japan that radiation levels recorded at a village about 25 miles from a stricken nuclear power plant are over the recommended levels. Japan set up a 12.5-mile evacuation zone around the plant and maintained that people living further away were safe for about 2 weeks. However, as this crisis worsened, officials started advising people living up to 19 miles away to consider leaving voluntarily. And Japan is to decommission the 4 stricken reactors at the quake-hit Fukushima nuclear plant. The Tokyo Electric Power made the announcement 3 weeks after failing to bring the reactors 1 through 4 under control. Harmful levels of radioactivity have been detected in the area. More than 11,000 people are known to have been killed by the devastating March 11th earthquake and tsunami, and many, many more remain missing. 9 Alabama hospital patients who were treated with intravenous feeding bags contaminated with bacteria have died, and the maker has pulled the product off the market. 10 others who got the nutrient treatments that are delivered directly from the plastic bags into the bloodstream through IV tubes were also sickened by the outbreak of bacteria. All of the patients were critically ill before receiving the IVs, and officials have not definitively tied the deaths to the outbreak of the 6 hospitals. The FDA examining the link between dyes found in everyday foods and hyperactivity in children. At a 2-day meeting, an FDA advisory committee will decide whether available data links the dyes and the disorder. The panel will recommend whether the agency should further regulate dyes, do more studies on the issue, or require better labeling of the additives. They could also recommend that the FDA do nothing at all. Susan Smith Jones has assisted thousands of people in becoming more aware of how their food and lifestyle choices affect their physical, emotional, and mental well-being. Susan, what's your take on this story here? Finally, these dyes, I think, should have been banned a long time ago, but what do you think is going to happen?
You know, absolutely, they should. And it's amazing that Tom called me not long ago to see if I could talk about this, because you didn't know this either, did Tom? Earlier today, I posted a major blog on my website all about food dyes, why you need to avoid them, how to get the toxic residues out of your body, and, you know, what are we going to do about this? So that's on my website. But here's the takeaway. Here's what you need to know. There are food colorings and artificial food colorings in all kinds of foods, not just candy, but bagels, pickles, macaroni and cheese, fruit rolls, soft drinks, chips, crackers, gelatins, cereals, and so much more. And here's a shocker, George. There are even artificial food dyes in pet foods. Now, how bizarre is that, since some animals like dogs see in limited color, but for some reason, the pet owners would prefer to have their animal's food in more vibrant colors rather than the dull gray dog chow. Now, we know there have been lots of studies lately taking a closer look, and many of them have shown a correlation between artificial food dyes and hyperactivity in adults, but especially in children. But it doesn't stop there, because these toxic artificial colors also cause allergic reactions, stress the liver that needs to metabolize all these chemicals, and, George, they can also be carcinogenic. So I always say, why play Russian roulette with your diet and your body? You want to avoid artificial colorings and dyes whenever possible, and because our bodies weren't designed for this overload of toxicity. So what do you do? You know, because they're ubiquitous. They're all over. And I suggest that, first of all, you might want to take a magnifying glass with you to the supermarket, because often the print is so small that you can't see it. Or I'll tell you what I just did 2 weeks ago. I got an app for my cell phone, and it turns my cell phone into a magnifying glass. So you've got to become a detective, and you've got to start reading labels of everything you want to purchase and get in the habit of purchasing those foods that don't need labels. Also, there are some natural colorings that it's okay to ingest. You know, some of them are carotene, powdered beets, saffron, paprika, your favorite, turmeric. So those are good. And here's my tip for the month. I want to recommend all of your listeners, and this will take a commitment, but, you know, we just turned into spring. When we have a change of season, it's a great time to upgrade your diet and detox. So make a commitment for 30 days to go without any artificial colorings for both children and adults. And you start, George, by sweeping clean your kitchen cupboards, your pantry, and your refrigerator.
That is a good idea. And Susan's website, SusanSmithJones.com. Boy, I invite all of you to go take a look at some of the things that she posts. In New Jersey, a jury has started deliberating the case of a woman who says she can't close her eyes. That's right. She can't close her eyes even when she sleeps. She's blaming an eyelid procedure gone bad. She said she went to a plastic surgeon to correct bumps on her eyelids from a cosmetic procedure performed by another doctor, and now she says she can't fully close her eyes at all. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Jim Steinmeier as we talk about the last greatest magician in the world. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I don't know about you, but I like magic. It fascinates me. And Jim Steinmeier has worked behind the scenes with well-known magicians developing material for their performances and creating special effects for Broadway shows. He's also a historian of magic. His previous books, Hiding the Elephant and The Glorious Deception, detail the very colorful magicians and how they develop their secrets. His latest work, The Last Greatest Magician in the World. Here's Jim Steinmeier. Split show tonight on Coast to Coast. Jim, how are you? Welcome.
Thanks, George. It's great to be with you.
My pleasure. You've done a lot of work in magic, and I want to talk with you about some of the things that you've done. Then we'll get into your incredible story here of Howard Thurston. What kind of magicians have you worked with over the years?
Oh, I've had the opportunity to work with a bunch of magicians over the years, or really kind of all the top magicians around the world. I started working early in my career with Doug Henning, when he was doing television specials and Broadway shows, and then I developed material for David Copperfield, Siegfried and Roy, and about 2 years ago, I had a chance to develop a magic circus for Ringling Brothers, Barnum & Bailey. So it's been a little bit of everything from Broadway shows to television shows to nightclubs and performing magicians. So there's always a lot of excitement and all different styles of magic and different performers, and everyone brings something different to the game.
I had an opportunity to see Chris Angel in Las Vegas, and I don't know if he's an illusionist or a magician, but whatever he is, he's pretty darn good.
He does a little bit of everything, and he does an amazing show.
How can you trick people, or at least baffle them, to the point where they don't know what's going on? How does that happen?
Well, you know, it's really an old art, and about it. 2 years ago, I worked on a book for Taschen, which was a big kind of art book about magic with some other authors, Mike Caveney and Ricky Jay, that was a history, a visual history of magic. And it's amazing how old an art this is, and also how unchanging it is, which is to say that the things that fooled people in the 1400s and the 1500s still fool us today. You know, we're also conscious of technology and how sophisticated we've all gotten. But it's still the same basic elements, you know, sleight of hand and visual illusions that amaze us. And I always say the tricks that would fool your grandparents and your great-grandparents would still fool you today. Because it's those kind of fairy tale elements, those sort of basic, substantial things that we all take for granted, that the magician uses and turns that logic against you and deceives you.
Well, in Chris Angel's case, Jim, I'm watching him. He's on stage. And he's got a woman right next to him, right next to him on stage. He holds up a blanket, and he covers her up. He counts to three. He drops the blanket over her head, and it sinks to the ground. It falls to the ground. She's not there. In 3 seconds, one, two, three, she's gone. She's behind everybody at the end of the theater, which has got to be 900 feet away. How did she do that? She didn't fall through some trap door. She couldn't get back there that fast.
Right, right.
I don't understand.
Well, you know, there have been all sorts of sophisticated methods over the years and improvements in the art and people that have improved it and inventors and a lot of technology devoted to it. But it's always still the basic elements of, you know, appearance and disappearance and those kind of visual tricks and those sort of psychological tricks that have been used to accentuate all of those things. I bet if you could analyze that performance, not taking anything away from Chris, because this is why he's great.
That's right.
If you analyze that performance, you know, you're looking at that as a witness, and the way you recall that performance, I'm sure, is nuanced with slight things that he's planted in your mind, psychological touches as well, that all accentuate the effect. If you went back and looked at it in real time, it would be amazing. But he planted certain things in your mind as you were watching it to make it even better in the retelling.
I kept thinking, am I looking at a hologram of the woman on stage? No, I don't think I was.
Right.
Is there a mirror around him where maybe she's being reflected from some picture? I don't know. But whatever he's doing, it's great technology, and he's a genius at what he does.
Absolutely.
Tell me about your interest in magic. How this all start for you?
Well, I started, you know, as a boyhood magician. My older brother was a magician, and you know, for him it was a hobby, and he had friends that did it. And when he gave it up, when he became a little bit older, I inherited the drawer full of magic tricks and books, and I didn't give it up. As a teacher in school said to me, "Oh, I went through that phase too." But at the point at which he said it to me, I had been about 10 years in that phase. So I never really stopped. I performed through college and through high school, through my school years. And then I was hired by Doug Henning to develop material for him. I had freelance material to him. And by that time, I realized that I was pretty good at thinking about this stuff and really interested in it, but I was not a great performer. I'd had a chance to work with really great performers. And that's when you talk about people like Chris Angel and Doug Henning, David Copperfield, Siegfried and Roy, Penn and Teller, you know, these are really, really skillful performers as well as thinkers. And so they bring an amazing amount to the performance. And so I had an opportunity to work with them on shows and develop material that then they made really shine in front of an audience.
Well, so, see, that's important, Jim, because I think Copperfield's show is spectacular compared to Chris Angel. I wasn't that impressed with the show. I mean, he's great at what he does, but the show itself wasn't very exciting. I mean, he had, you know, people dressed up as rabbits jumping around, and I just didn't like it.
Well, you know, the other thing is that the other thing you have to realize, and this gets into the books that I've been writing, is that, you know, the fashions have really changed over the years too. And I would even say David's show has changed, and what Chris has been doing has changed over the years. And at various times, those people were doing bigger shows or smaller shows or more intimate shows or more personal shows, and then big production shows. You know, obviously the biggest show of those ever was Siegfried and Roy, and then Lance Burton did a large show in Las Vegas for many years. So, but all of those are kind of fashions. That's sort of the fashion of how magic is presented. And those things change and get altered, and even within our lifetimes and within several years, a performer will change his performance style. But the elements of it, the basic elements of it, are still the same.
We didn't have radio, we didn't have television in the old days, so magicians probably were just incredible talent and great shows for people of that era, weren't they?
They got on a train and they came to your city, and it was really just like a circus in those days. You know, I mean, a circus and a magic show, those were genres of entertainment, and a magic show was something that came through town, and several magicians. You know, there were a number of great magicians that traveled around the country and around the world, this happened, and brought their shows. And depending on the size of the show and the complexity of the show, it would take one railroad car or eight railroad cars in the case of Thurston, and 40 tons of scenery and apparatus and 30 assistants. And just like a touring Broadway show, really on the level of a Barnum and Bailey or Ziegfeld. I mean, in his day, Thurston had a name that was equal to that. He was an entertainment commodity. Just like if you were to say Jolson or you were to say George M. Cohen, you know, Thurston was known around the country as America's great magician.
Did he perform in tents, theaters, all over the place?
Well, the little secret about Thurston and why it is maybe, I think, one of the most amazing stories in all of entertainment in American show business is that throughout his career, he did everything. He started. He literally started his career as a pickpocket on the streets of New York, which of course isn't really a career. I should say it that way, but he started right at the bottom and was almost institutionalized. It was a miracle that he was not put in jail as a young man, and he just slowly worked his way up. And he did everything, and just like you said, everything. He did sideshows. He was a talker in the front of sideshows, a pitchman. Managed sideshows. He traveled through the far west on a buckboard wagon, taking shows to miners and prospectors, taking a magic show. He was broke many times in his career, didn't know where he was going to go next, and then suddenly, with this act that he had been working on slowly over the years, became the greatest act in American vaudeville and was a sensation doing an act with just a deck of cards.
Well, he was born in 1869. That's died right. In 1936. Mm-hmm. And, Jim, we're going to come back in just a moment. We'll talk about Howard Thurston, why he was so important in the world of magic, what people who adore Harry Houdini think of Howard Thurston as well. Jim's website, jimsteinmeier.com. is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. It's an incredible story about an incredible man, and we'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Jim Steinmeier. Perhaps you can share your magic stories with us or just have a question or two, and we'll be back with him in just a moment. Hey, are you a Coast Insider? You can be for just 25 cents a day, a little less as well, and get podcasting downloads and just have some darn right fun. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com, and you can sign up. You get immediate response there to become a Coast Insider. We'll be right back with Jim Steinmeier on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here we are with Jim Steinmeier. We're talking about his work, The Last Greatest Magician in the World. It's about the life of Howard Thurston. Again, he was born in 1869, died in 1936. He started his journey as a pickpocket. Tell us more, Jim.
Well, he really had just about every experience that you could have in those days in show business. And he was there right at the beginning of vaudeville with an amazing act that involved just a pack of playing cards and a sleight of hand with playing cards. And, of course, everyone told him that you couldn't do that. That was suitable maybe for a men's club, but you couldn't actually do that on stage. And he took America by storm and then went over to Europe and took London by storm and then went to the continent and was an enormous success. And then in a moment of clarity, which is marvelous to consider even today, he somehow knew that vaudeville wasn't the answer, even though everyone else was convinced that it would live forever. Mm-hmm. And he decided to take out his own show. And he then constructed an enormous magic show, tons and tons of apparatus that he took on a journey around the world. And while he was around the world, he heard that America's great magician, Harry Keller, would be retiring. And he made arrangements with him and came back to America and was, in essence, kind of crowned the next great magician for the public. Harry Keller retired and proclaimed that Thurston was his successor, and he would take over his route and his show and would then become, as he said in all the posters, the greatest magician the world has ever known. And for just about 30 years, Thurston continued that tradition through American cities and took his show around America, and the show became more and more elaborate every year. He featured things like the disappearing horse, the disappearing automobile, the Indian rope trick, of course, the levitation of Princess Karnak, which was included in every single performance.
Hey, a couple of years ago with this economy, we were doing our own disappearing automobile trick, weren't we?
Not that kind of disappearing automobile.
Yeah, really. No, we don't want that. Well, he sounds like he was a great showman.
He was a fantastic showman, and he had a really elegant kind of magisterial, ministerial manner on stage that charmed everyone. He was obviously a great man of the theater and with a great presence.
Did he have construction people build his tricks? How did he know how to do that?
He always depended on a group of people. You know, there were always Thurston's men around. And I think he drove some of them kind of crazy because he was always making demands of them. You can see that there were waves of people that came through, but he always depended on a number of great magicians behind the scenes, great thinkers who were responsible for coming up with his illusions. And he had his own ideas, and he worked with them to improve them, the illusions over the years. But yes, in the summer months, he had a home in Long Island, in Queens, in Whitestone, and he worked on the new illusions there, and they were built every year in a barn there, and then they'd be taken on the road, and the new show would go out. He was always dependent on putting new magic in front of his public. His idea was that you came back to the same cities over and over again, and that you built up clientele, and people would want to see you again and again.
Well, and he's right. And then you throw in a new trick or two.
A new trick or two. He wouldn't stop at a new trick or two. He changed the show tremendously and always added tremendously to it. And I met people all my life. They're going away now because Thurston last performed in 1935. So those people who saw him, there are very few now who remember seeing him. But when I was growing up, I always had memories of people would tell me their memories of the Thurston show. The princess that floated in the middle of the stage, the ball that would float over the stage and into the audience, the spirits that appeared in the spirit cabinet, him throwing playing cards up into the balcony of the theater. He did an illusion called Aesia, which was a woman who went into a prayer cage, and the cage was lifted out over the heads of the audience.
Oh my!
It was rigged over the audience, and the cabinet went up to the ceiling of the theater and then fell open, and she was gone.
See, and this is in late 1800, early 1900 technology.
His career was in the late 1800s. When he was working in America as the great magician, it was between 1908 and 1936. Those tricks were from the 20s. Yeah.
That is amazing. How did he come up with this?
He was always, always looking for new ideas and always kept people on their toes developing ideas for him. He was one of the first magicians in America to present the illusion of sawing a woman in half. And it was a huge feature in his show. I mean, it was a great comedy number, and he a huge bit of presentation for him. And he presented it from 1921 until 1936, and he always included it. And in his programs, it always said, by public request, sawing a woman in half. And it was by public request. It was something everyone wanted to see. And Thurston did it unlike anybody else.
I bet it was one of the tricks he would probably perform right at the end, just as a great show would. A showbuster, wasn't it?
He would always move things around, and he was very conscious about where things were placed in the show to create the maximum effect. It's funny that you say that. He usually ended his show with a big spectacle, but right before that, he would do something really sweet and intimate. For many, many years, he did a trick where he would produce a rabbit and then offer to give it to a little girl in the audience, and when he wrapped it up, it would change into a box of candy.
He and created the awe effect, didn't he?
He always, always played to get the personality across to the audience, and he always intermixed that with the great big spectacle pieces so that people didn't lose him in the middle of it.
Was it easy to research him when you wrote the book, The Last Greatest Magician in the World, or was it difficult?
Boy, you know, there were so many great magic collectors and historians and people who were interested in the subject. And I really benefited from the collections of several of those people. There's a collector in New York, Rory Feldman, and one in Ohio, Ken Klosterman, and Mike Caveney in Los Angeles, good friends of mine who had tremendous collections of Thurston material and had been putting together letters and pictures and diaries and notebooks over the years. And there really were dozens of collectors that I benefited from over the years. And so the research was fun to do, and everybody had some treasures that they were willing to share. And the story was put together really like a jigsaw puzzle.
You said he was kind of obsessed about Indian magic. Tell me about this.
Well, early in his travels, when he took this big show out, he traveled, he started going from the west coast of America to Australia, and then he was determined to take it through the Orient, and he went up to China, and then he decided to go to India. And everyone told him, you can't go to India, don't go to India. This was about 1905, 1907. And they said, you can't take a show of that size to India. And in fact, the only way he did it was he had his own tent made so that he could ensure that the theater was large enough and that it was to his specifications because the show was so elaborate. But when he got to India, he was obsessed with the idea of seeing real Indian magic. And he had all of the great Indian street magicians brought to his hotel so that he could see what they were doing. And when they weren't good enough, he insisted on meeting a real Indian yogi, you know, someone who had said that he had mastered these skills, and interviewing him and talking to him and finding out what he could do. And he was told that this man, after a diet of sheep's blood and meditation and fasting, he would be able to actually levitate for him. But Thurston never actually saw that happen. But he was always interested in those phenomena all through his life, and he told his company that if he saw something like that, that they should be ready. He would leave the show, and he would learn what those wise men knew, and he would devote his life to that, and he wouldn't keep going with his tour. That was so important to him, if he really saw something like that, that he would stop his career and learn it.
Jim, did he delve into the supernatural as Harry Houdini did?
Houdini was both a friend and an enemy, a rival and a business associate all their lives. They started kind of at the same level in World's Fair in 1893. Houdini had a completely different approach. Houdini, was an arch skeptic and really took on the issue of spiritualism.
Right.
Thurston always kept an open mind about it. He has a very, very funny, fluid kind of faith all through his career. He was always interested in the subject. He always said that he believed that those things are possible, but that he hadn't seen it. At various times, he said he had seen things that were completely unexplainable. He's had him sitting with a medium, an Italian medium, who clearly fooled him very badly. I mean, he had no idea how it was done, and he vouched for her and said that he thought that some of the things that she did were genuine. He ended up being slightly more skeptical, and he thought that anything that was done for money, anything that was done kind of on demand, probably wasn't real. But he still held out the faith that there was real, genuine psychic phenomenon. And over that point, he and Houdini disagreed violently.
Most people have heard the name Houdini. Why haven't we all heard about Howard Thurston?
Well, it's really interesting. In their day, I have it on authority of the people who worked for them, who were their contemporaries. In their day, he was as well known, if not better known, than Houdini. First of all, they were in two completely different markets. Houdini, most of his career, was working in vaudeville, and he did an escape act. He was known by the public generally as an escape artist. And so when Houdini was a star of vaudeville theaters and was known for getting out of things and known for these unbelievable publicity stunts, he really invented his own career in that way.
And the vaudeville theaters, just set the stage real quickly, Jimmy, for us. Mm-hmm. They would have like an orchestra there and...
They were first-class productions, but a vaudeville theater was about going in and seeing 12 acts that night. You know, there would be an opening act, there would be a juggler, there would be so they were short acts.
And maybe a host would come in and introduce them?
Yeah, actually, in vaudeville in those days, the MCs kind of came in later, kind of in the 30s. That sort of became part of that formula. But in the teens and the 20s, when vaudeville started, you know, that's the old thing where there would be a card at the side of the stage and announcing the name of the act, and they would change the card. There were electric annunciators. There were electric signs at the side that would flash with the names of the acts. And Houdini was a star, which means that Houdini... just about closed the show. He was right at the end of the show. And he would be, unlike the other acts who would have 10 minutes, Houdini would have 20 or 30 minutes. You know, he would have the feature spot. And the week after that, if you saw him in Chicago, he would get on the train with his assistants, and he would go to Milwaukee, and he would do the escape act in Milwaukee for a theater there, and then he would get on the train the next week, and he would go to another vaudeville theater. So it was a circuit of theaters all across the country.
And he probably got a higher percent of the gate than some of the other vaudeville acts.
He was a very well-paid, he was at the top of the game and was really successful. And again, you know, he completely invented himself, and not only that, invented this whole thing of the escape artist. You know, there really wasn't anything like that before Houdini came along. There were some tricks involving getting out of rope ties, but the whole notion of presenting that as a feature was a novelty, and it really was Houdini who did that. You know, his whole personality took that on. He was a little man that you couldn't contain, you couldn't lock him down, you couldn't hold him. He would get out of anything, and there was a kind of pose in that. There was a sort of a swagger in it, and it really turned him into a sort of superhero.
Was Thurston ever in the same vaudeville show as Houdini?
They never worked together in the same show. They were absolutely in the same cities at the same time. When Thurston was doing his card act and when Houdini was doing his escape act, they were both stars of vaudeville at the same time. Thurston very quickly got out of vaudeville, and Houdini kept going for many years. But yes, they were. They were absolute contemporaries, and they were always nipping at each other's heels. You know, they were kind of friendly rivals, who sometimes that rivalry boiled over. But there were always parallels in their career. They're always kind of at the same point. One's getting a little ahead, and then the other one catches up and gets a little ahead. So part of the fun of the story is this rivalry between these two performers.
Tony Curtis played Harry Houdini in the movie. I can't recall anybody playing Howard Thurston.
No, Howard Thurston tried a couple films himself, some silent films, just as Houdini had a film career of his own, but not very successfully. You know, Thurston was really known as a magician, and that just didn't translate to motion pictures. There kind of wasn't a need for it. Houdini's escapes, although Houdini didn't have a great film career either, at least his escapes were kind of a sort of stunt work, and they were appreciated as that. Thurston didn't have any luck in motion pictures, and he tried a Broadway show, he tried to write a mystery show, but really people wanted to see Thurston. People wanted to see his magic, and it was elegant, and it was sophisticated, and it was colorful, and, you know, it was all those kind of things, you know, firing the gun in the air and 20 showgirls disappear in a flash of fire. All those kind of great cliches of a magic show, those were all wrapped up in the Thurston show with his personality.
Jim, to me, it's critical that a talk show host respects his listeners, that a movie performer or a theater performer respects his audience. How did Thurston react to the people who came to see him?
Well, it's really interesting. It's interesting you say that. You know, one of the Thurston legacies, if you read Dale Carnegie's book, you'll find a couple paragraphs about Howard Thurston, even though Thurston is forgotten today. Carnegie knew Thurston, and Thurston was, again, he had his very funny relationship with the paranormal and with faith and with religion. And as I said, he started out a con man, and he told people he was trained for the ministry, which he wasn't. But he had a kind of religious nature at times, and at other times people denied that he had it. But the one thing he always had faith in was his audience. He always had enormous respect for his audience. And I tell a story in the book about a performer who worked with him, who learned the ropes working for Thurston when he was a boy, a magician named Fred Keating, who did become one of those kind of sophisticated nightclub performers you were talking about, an MC and a master of ceremonies, a kind of funny, dry performer. And when he was a success, Thurston came to see Keating work. And Keating, of course, kind of did insult humor with the audience and, you know, that sort of style then. And Thurston came to see him and said he liked the show, but he warned him. He said, "You're making a big mistake, Fred." He said, "Remember, they are the ones that pay your salary." And he said, "You need to have humility."
Good.
And he knew it because Keating knew it because everyone who had worked with Thurston had seen his ritual. Thurston had a ritual before every show started. He would stand behind the curtain as close as he could to the audience without being seen as the overture was being played, and he would whisper through the curtain, "I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you." And he would visualize the people in his audience. And that's all he wanted to do. That's what he wanted to do, was convey that appreciation and that love the moment the curtain opened.
He understood. He understood people. I think that's critical.
Absolutely.
Back to the Houdini-Thurston comparison then. So why today do most people know the name Harry Houdini, but hardly anybody knows Howard Thurston?
That is the big question. A friend of mine who had worked with both of them, a writer named Walter Gibson, told me all of Thurston's publicity was about getting you in the theater, and all of Houdini's publicity was about creating a legend. And he said every day that passes, they both got what they wanted. Thurston got people in the theater, and as the years pass, Houdini becomes more and more famous. You have to remember, Houdini was the first real celebrity who had a publicist hired for him after he was dead to keep his name alive.
Okay.
Now that's a very modern, I mean, it's a remarkably modern thing. The reason we recognize Houdini and really think he's a marvelous fellow today is because of the modernness of what he was doing. A friend of mine named Bill Kalush wrote a great biography of Houdini a few years ago that pointed that out, that Houdini was really the first modern celebrity.
But you know what, Jim? I'd rather have the publicist work for me while I'm alive than when I'm dead.
Well, I would say what's fascinating to me about the Thurston story is that, you know, we know many, many, many people now that think of fame the way Houdini thought of fame. If you turn on American Idol any week, you know, you'll meet 10 of them.
Yeah.
But what's amazing is the way Thurston thought of fame and the way Thurston hid elements of his past. You know, Thurston really concealed more about himself than he let the audience see. And he was very careful about what he showed and what he didn't show. And it was a different style of what he would show, wanted the audience to know about himself. And that, to me, was kind of is the genius of the story, is what he concealed as a magician as well as what he showed the audience. The old style of how you conducted yourself in front of the audience and how you achieved fame. And that's really why he was the last of those great magicians.
Was he, in your opinion, was he brilliant?
Oh, there's no question he was a brilliant performer. I mean, he really was America's great magician. From 1908 to 1936, it said it on the posters, and there wasn't any contention about it. He inherited a tradition that was handed down, and he not only lived up to it, he surpassed it. The show got bigger, more spectacular every year, and he was a star of the American stage.
Jim, because of your background helping magicians and your work here with this book, The Last Greatest Magician in the World, when we come back at the top of the hour, let's take some phone calls. I'd like for you to share stories with Jim Steinmeier about your love of magic, or perhaps ask him a question. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.